is just past 1:30 on December 18, 2018. I'm Randy Christman, Chairman of the Public Service Commission, joined by Commissioners Brian Krashus and Julie Fedorchek. I don't have any opening comments. Do either of you?
No, welcome.
No, none for me either. Thanks.
Okay, so we'll turn it over to you. Have everybody probably go around the table and introduce themselves. It's going to be talking or at the table. We have different microphones than what you're used to, so you no longer need to pull them like within a half of an inch of your mouth. And in fact, it's best to leave them out about at the edge of the table is when it seems to work out best for the recording. So thank you for being here.
Perfect.
Are you going to kick it off now?
Yes, thank you. So thanks for taking the time. We've got several items on the agenda, and maybe what I'll do too, like you suggested, just start by doing introductions of those that are at the table and will be presenting. So we'll start with you, Larry.
Yeah, Larry Oswald, Director of Business Development and Energy Programs for Montana Dakota Utilities.
Garrett Singer, Vice President, Regulatory Affairs and Customer Service.
Peggy Link, I'm with MDU Resources, Vice President and Chief Information Officer.
Pat Harris, Vice President, Engineering and Operations.
Kevin Connell, Director of Gas Supply.
So maybe a little new to the table in terms of folks that you haven't seen before would be Peggy Link, and she'll be presenting to you on cybersecurity and, you know, what we have going on. I know it's taken on quite an interest, quite frankly, nationally, but from our commissions across our eight-state territory. So Peggy has been doing a little bit of a roadshow via telephonically, giving updates to our commissioners in terms of what we're doing to protect our customer information as well as our assets. So Peggy would be, I think, new to you or most of you. So just wanted to give a little more background on her. And then Kevin Connell is new to our group, not new to the corporation, but he came over from WBI and is at MDU as our gas supply director, and he'll be giving a gas supply update. So just
welcome, Kevin and Peggy.
Yes.
Thank you.
So maybe just to quickly cover off on the agenda here, the couple topics we wanted to cover off, all of a few topics in terms of opening remarks, and then as I mentioned, Peggy will talk about cybersecurity. Pat Darris, who you've all met before, is going to give a little bit of an update with respect to what took place in Massachusetts and what that may mean for our system here in North Dakota. And then we've got Kevin talking about gas supply, and Larry Oswald will give an update on Bobcat and Gwinner. And then certainly we're open to any other topics that may come up. In front of you also would be what we call an infographic that we've put together. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but just a leave-behind piece for you so that you understand, again, that we are operating under four separate brands across eight states serving over a million customers. So this gives a little bit of detail in terms of the different brands in which we operate, where we serve, and, you know, some of the happenings going on. And then on the opposite side of that is really an overview of our electric system. So, again, that would be specific to Montana Dakota Utilities only. The other brands that we operate are gas only. So I won't spend a lot of time on that. I'm just going to move ahead here to a couple items that I had to update you on before we get into the specific topics. So since we've last met, Thunder Spirit Wind Expansion, we've got that purchase completed. So maybe just taking you back a little bit in history, the first phase of Thunder Spirit was a 107.5-megawatt project. We purchased that from Elite Clean Energy, and then as part of our last IRP, the expansion of Thunder Spirit came out as a least cost resource for our customers, so we proceeded with Elite Clean Energy constructing the second phase, which was 48 megawatts. So basically all told, both projects together at 155 megawatts, providing about 27% of our overall capacity then from renewable resources.
27%?
27%. We do have a 20-year maintenance agreement on both Phase 1 and Phase 2 with Nordex, and essentially what that has done for us is limit our exposure on repair and maintenance. And so we've got excited about that being completed and up and running. Actually, the other day when I looked, Thunder Spirit alone was actually our top producing generating facility across our footprint. So happy to have that project up and running. So that was topic one on my list to give you a quick update. Number two here you can see is the integrated resource plan now that we're currently working on. So again, I just alluded to the 2017. We're currently in the process of working through our 2019 integrated resource plan. Maybe just taking you back real briefly to 2017's IRP. And that, as a reminder, we did have the working assumption around the retirement of Heskett and Lewis and Clark in the 2025 timeframe. In addition, that IRP suggested that we would build a combined cycle gas facility. So I'm not here to make any announcements. We are still way early in the process in terms of, so we haven't made any final decisions on our IRP, but just giving you an update that we continue to work through the information, a lot of data being gathered. Certainly as we look to our coal assets, obviously the things we're contemplating is age of the facilities, you know, what kind of capital we have to put into the facilities to keep them running, pending environmental rules and regulations that could cause incremental expenditures, and then really their competitiveness in the marketplace. So we're evaluating all of that. We're also looking at what that next generation resource potentially will be, and again, haven't made any decisions on that yet, but we'll be working through that process. So just wanted to let you know we're in the middle of that. And then we will, of course, come back to you as we get more information with respect to that. Third area I wanted to cover is just the corporate reorganization. So North Dakota had approved this. You're aware that MDU Resources in Montana, Dakota, we were going to do a corporate restructure there. And we did get our last state approval on that. And so we have all the states and FERC approvals. And so our intentions are to move forward effective 1-1 and probably an announcement on 1-2 of 2019 with the reorganization. And again, as a reminder, what we're essentially doing there is making MDU Resources a holding company. And so Montana, Dakota will be a subsidiary of MDU Resources instead of a division of, and then Great Plains will be a division of Montana, Dakota. So the update really for you is just it is proceeding as we expected. We've received all the approvals, and we expect beginning of 2019 that will be behind us.
Repeat the order. Yep. Is that in here, Nicole?
So Montana, our MDU Resources will be the ultimate parent.
MDU Resources.
Yep. And then Montana, Dakota will be a subsidiary of MDU Resources. Great Plains will be a division of Montana, Dakota. And then just so you know, if you go to this sheet here, the other brands in which we operate, they function the same. Intermountain is a subsidiary of MDU Resources, and so is Cascade. So basically Montana, Dakota will be on the same level, per se, now as the other sister companies.
Is there any thought being given, or did I hear something once? Is Great Plains in the planning to be just taken in as a full part of MDU Gas, or
in regards to North Dakota Great Plains? That's what, you know, that's the long-term plan, is that combined in with Montana.
But that's not a part of this yet?
No.
Okay. Yeah, Nicole, can we go back a bit to the IRP?
Yes.
Were you done with the corporate reorg?
Yes.
Okay. If you said the 2017 plan called for the retirement of those of Heskett and the Lewis and Clark in 2025?
That was the working assumption in
the
that
IRP.
Assumption. Yep.
And so as you go through the 2019 plan and kind of test and see if that's still the time frame or whatever, if you were to stick with that time frame, when would you have to make, like, the firm decision to that's when it's going to be in order to actually back it down and then have it replaced or whatever you're going to – whatever your plan would be to replace it?
Yeah, a piece of that would be predicated on what the replacement resource is. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's being looked at.
Sure.
Is, you know, on a combined cycle replacement, clearly that is a much longer construction period than some of the other options that are on the table. So it really will be determined based on what the replacement resource is. And again, all the other factors that I mentioned, such as how competitive are our facilities currently in the marketplace, how much capital do we have in the ensuing years, what kind of environmental regulations are these facilities facing. So there's a lot of math that goes into what's the business case, and that's really what we're putting together. I would expect that we will have more information. In fact, we've got a bunch of internal meetings set up through January. We will probably have, you know, more information by February timeframe. Sometime in the first quarter, we'd probably come back to you with what that information is telling us. Yes.
How many megawatts is that, the two of those?
So if you turn over the infographic that we gave you, you can see Heskett.
Oh, sure.
One is 25 megawatts. Two is a 75-megawatt facility, and then Lewis and Clark is 44.
And would Heskett 1 and 2, or are you just talking
The working about assumption last time was it was Heskett 1 and 2. Yep, they were built around the same time frame, as you can tell, 1954 and 1963, and Lewis and Clark was 1958.
Okay. And are you looking at market purchases to replace that or not? You'd put something in the ground?
We're looking at all the information, but most likely, you know, we'll want to have some resource from a capacity perspective, because if you were going to make a decision, such as the working assumption that was in the last IRP, you need some capacity, right? And we would also be looking at reliability, the load pocket here in Bismarck. So there's a lot of things that go into play here. And that's why I think it's probably we would come back to you and have maybe a separate meeting to walk through some of this information. There's a lot at play, and we haven't had all of our internal meetings yet to get those conclusions established. But I just wanted to update you that we are working through that process, and then just a reminder in terms of what was in the last IRP. Okay, then the last topic I had would be just to give you an update in terms of the utility group reorganization is what we called it on here. But if you see on the next slide, really what I wanted to update you on is we've looked at our officer team really a little bit differently than we have in the past. And so the big change that we made here in 2018 was to look at our operations officers. So I'll just say it as simply as I can. We used to have a VP of operations. So you are all aware of Pat Darris. He was the VP of Ops for MDU and Great Plains. We had an equivalent position that ran Cascade, and then we had an equivalent position that ran Intermountain. What we have decided to do is look at our organization really from an officer leadership perspective as one utility. And so I have made each of those individuals have responsibility over a functional area, but across the entire eight-state footprint. So Pat Darris's new role is VP of Engineering and Ops Services across the entire eight-state footprint, and he will explain to you, I think, when he talks about this incident that we just took place in Massachusetts, how this is really helping us look at things now instead of just for utility by utility. We got one person looking at what lessons can we learn from an incident such as this, and how would that apply across the system instead of just having three separate people look at this under three separate eyes. So that's Pat Darris's new role. Eric Martiselli is now running field ops across the entire eight-state footprint. And then Hart Gilchrist is looking at safety, process improvement, and then operations technology. And so I can get into more detail if you want, but essentially the simplest way to explain it is the way we have set up our officer team now is all officers have responsibility across our entire eight-state footprint. So looking at the leadership structure just slightly different than we did in the past. And that is all I had, unless you guys have questions on that before we move on. Okay, all right. I'm going to turn it over to Peggy to give you an update on cybersecurity.
Thank you, Nicole, and thank you guys for the opportunity to be here today to talk about cybersecurity. I am at MDU Resources, and for our corporation, IT cybersecurity is at the MDU Resources level, similar to what Nicole mentioned with the consolidation by functional group within the utility group. We did a similar thing several years ago in the IT to give this an advantage of looking across our entire enterprise when it came to sharing services with technology or with cybersecurity. So I've been with the corporation for 14 years, and every day that I've been here, cybersecurity has been a very important and critical day-to-day function of my job. Now, certainly in IT, so cybersecurity is not new, but we've seen how, certainly over the last few years, how cybersecurity has certainly become much more challenging and definitely is on top on everybody's radar. When I'm talking about cybersecurity, what I wanted to do is give you a little overview of our cybersecurity program and the success of our cybersecurity program and what we're doing and how we're measuring whether or not our cybersecurity program is successful. So I like to use this this graph. It's not mine. It's from 2014, but it's a really good, simple way of looking at organizationals and the maturity level of a cybersecurity program. And that's what, in cybersecurity, it's not a project, it's a program. It's never ending when it comes to cybersecurity. 14 years ago when I joined the organization, we would have been considered both MDU Resources, Montana Dakota, very basic organization when it came to cybersecurity. It was ad hoc. It was a necessary evil. Nobody really wanted to talk about it. It was IT's problem. It certainly wasn't a business topic. And so our journey over the last 14 years has put us in the advanced organization. That is not my assessment alone. I'll share with you some of the assessments and the third-party tests that we do that validate that. But we have a cybersecurity. It's part of our culture. One of the biggest things that has happened over the last 14 years is taking that cybersecurity out of the server room and into the boardroom, where we take it from being an IT responsibility to really being a business risk. And I would say from a culture perspective, that has been the greatest advantage and to help us be successful in our cyber program and to make it part of our culture. So what I want to start with is governance. So we have what is a cyber risk oversight committee. And in 2014, our board of directors charged the CYROC is what we call it, to be responsible for our risk acceptance and our overall cyber program and posture. If you're familiar with the CYTAC, the State of North Dakota's Information Technology Advisory Group, I have the privilege of sitting on that for the last several years. And this is somewhat modeled after the state's CYTAC, but we focus it just directly on cybersecurity. And what the cybersecurity team does, we report quarterly to the board. The CYROC reviews any cyber risks, any third-party penetration tests or reviews that we have. We review the anatomy of breaches that are going on out in the wild. In 2018, there have been 18 reported breaches. We hear about the big ones. We hear about Starwood. We hear about, you know, Ticketmaster. But there are many more breaches, and the CYROC is taking a look at the IT and the security team bring back to the CYROC where we may have something that could have been breached based on the anatomy of the breaches that happen elsewhere, and is there something we need to do to bridge that gap? So there's a technology review, a risk acceptance. We have 20 members across our corporation that are part of that, but we have 7 voting members, and they are the members that vote on whether or not we are going to accept a risk or whether or not we are going to mitigate a risk. And for the utility group, Garrett is our voting member, and so he's very actively involved in our cybersecurity governance. The second part of our governance that is critical is we follow a framework. The framework is that we follow is the CIS Critical Security Controls. State of North Dakota follows NIST. We map to NIST, but we follow the CIS Critical Security Controls as well as our compliance and regulatory requirements. And the reason we follow the CIS Critical Security Controls is it's really a practical framework. And what this is it takes a look, again, at that anatomy of the breaches that are going on. And it helps enterprises or corporations prioritize what is going to have the greatest impact when you prioritize risks that are out there. And so we like this control framework. It helps us with our governance. It helps us keep focused. There's no shortage of good things that you can do from a cyber perspective. If you look at the world of cybersecurity or you just look at the world of technology, it's really rather immature. And we've only been using technology at the desktop since the 80s, and cybersecurity has really been in the last 15 years that it's really been something that we have to focus on. And so it's really immature, and having that framework to keep us focused and keep us prioritized is really an important part of our program. The CYROC then, we are assessed by third parties on how well we're following that framework, and the CYROC then receives those reports and we report then to the Board of Directors quarterly.
Who is CIS again? CIS, or what does that stand for?
It's critical information system. It's just it's from the SANS Institute. They just recently changed the name of that framework. It used to be it's just critical information security. So on a how we cybersecurity, you'll hear is everybody's responsibility, and if you're a technology person, you have cybersecurity as part of your day-to-day job. But we also have dedicated cybersecurity professionals, and we have operations technology dedicated team. And information technology. And the difference there, and we'll talk a little more in further slides, but operations technology would be that technology in the power plants at the wind farms. It's different than the computer sitting on your desk with Microsoft. There's two different, it's really two different disciplines. In the IT world, you can just reboot something if it doesn't work. You can't do that in a power plant or, you know, so it's really a different discipline. So we have a dedicated OT team. They come from the operations type of expertise, engineering, and they work closely with the subject matter experts within those assets, those critical assets, and then the information technology team. We have dedicated staff. We also have what we call our white hat hackers. This year we hired a person. One of the things to stay ahead of the bad guys, you need to be able to think like a bad guy. And so we hired one individual, and his job is to hack. He is inside. He works for us, and he hacks into our applications. He looks at our network. He looks at our websites. He's constantly looking at our code to see if we have any vulnerabilities. He looks at patch management. He is our internal hacker, and so that is his job, just to keep to find any vulnerabilities before the bad guys do. The second thing we do from a white hat hacking is we have a bug bounty program. We work with a third party, and they have ethical hackers on staff, and we have them really hack our external-facing website, so Montana Dakota's website, where our customers can log in and can get information and do. We have hackers that hack it, that are constantly looking to make sure that we do not have vulnerabilities and none of our customer information can be viewed from a hacker. So we only pay them if they find something, but it is a program that we really think is beneficial to our organization.
It's quite a title, ethical hacker.
Hacker, exactly. Right?
They actually take, it's funny, the ethical
hacker. What kind of scrutiny do they go through?
Yeah. they go through a lot of scrutiny, and they have a do no harm type of a oath they take. I mean, it's real Society of Ethical Hackers, but they're scary smart people, and we're fortunate to have them working with us. Then that penetration test and security, the security programs reviews that we have that validate that we are in an advanced on that first chart. We do penetration tests with a third party every year. And we change up the third parties we use to make sure that we're getting people looking at different things. So this year on our penetration test that we had for 4 days, again, hackers, the penetration testers, tried to access our network externally, and they were unable to. That was the first time that's happened, that we were able to make, that they weren't able to get in. And that's a really good news story. Now, when I get down to the phishing program, I'm going to tell you why that's not such a good news story. But it's a good news. I mean, that's exactly what, and we attribute it to those hacking programs that we have, that we're shoring up things before the bad guys can find them. Our security program reviews, that again is looking right at those critical, that framework, and so we have a third party that comes in and reviews, how are you doing? You say you're doing these things, are you? And they come in, and it's just like an audit. They come in and they look, and you can say you're doing it, but prove it, and you have to prove it. And again, we're certainly maturing our program in that regard as well. And then you look at layered security. So we look at layered security. you could, the more layers you put in, the more secure you're going to be. But the more layers you put in, the harder it is to use that technology for the efficiencies that we want technology to be used for. And so a very simple statement, we protect our pencils like they're pencils and our diamonds like they're diamonds. The utility group has a lot of diamonds. So when you're thinking about how many layers of security you put around something, if I have a department and they have a SharePoint site and it's really just sharing information, there's no confidential or sensitive information, you don't secure that as much as you would secure a power plant control room. You know, you put a lot more layers of security. And so we layer our security, and we're always improving and putting more layers of security on, but also trying we have to also work, you know, so how do you making sure that we're keeping that in check. And the final thing I wanted to talk to you about on cybersecurity, and I mentioned there's been 800 breaches that have been disclosed this year. 90% of those, it is estimated, were started because of a phish. It wasn't started because somebody from the external tried to get in by breaking in. It was because somebody let them in. And so while I think that penetration test gets us, we get really excited that we were able to keep them out, the phishing program and phishing is really still a very scary, scary thing for all organizations, certainly for ours. We started a very active phishing program in 2014. So we do a lot of testing and education and communications to our employees. And when we first started doing phishing, 20% of our employees would click on the test every time, and sometimes more. If you told them it was a reward or it was from HR and they were going to give them a bonus, we had a much higher click rate. Of course, you know. So even if it looked like it came, we said it comes from an external person. HR is not external. You know, it didn't matter. People clicked. But over the last 4 years, what we have found is through our program, we have cut that in half. The utility actually is about 9% or less for a click rate. And so it only takes one wrong click if you don't have the right protections, those right layers of security in place. So while we've stopped people from about half of the people or more at the utility from clicking, we've had to put technology in place also so that when they click, a malware can't execute on their computer. If they click, we're reviewing. If they go out and it says, hey, put your name and password in here, your credentials, and they steal those credentials, nobody can remote into our network without two-factor authentication and some other secret sauce that we don't necessarily describe, you know, in detail, checks and balances we have in place. And so we try to put technology in place to help back up education, but that is one of our if something keeps you up at night is somebody clicking on a link that they shouldn't have. And we still do have people that do that. Much improved, but and definitely better than, you know, industry average, but we always like to be lots better than industry average in those areas.
So what do you do to persuade your employees when they make the mistake when you're testing them to persuade them to be more cautious?
So we do a couple things. You know, one of the things that, you know, that is one of those areas where you look at it's kind of like even in safety. If we don't want to, you know, do you use a carrot or do you use a stick? You know, do you punish people for something, or do you try to educate and encourage? And we've taken the approach of not punishing per se unless they're just doing it all the time and they're just being careless. Because if we tell people you click on a link and we're going to fine you, you're going to go home without pay or whatever it is, they'll start using their personal email addresses for business. And we all know if we watch the national news, we don't want to do that. We don't want people using their personal emails for business. And so you want to make sure that you help them. So you click on a link. They're educated. They have an education. It says, hey, you clicked on a link. Here's what you should have done. We then send their supervisors know that they clicked on a link. And we ask their supervisors to please visit with them. Their VP knows they clicked on a link. And so then it becomes part of the everyday culture, clicking on a link. We try to educate We encourage. We don't have a lot of multiple clickers, and typically what we find is our clickers are because of turnover, employee turnover, the first-time clickers. And so getting to those people sooner is better. The other clickers.
Julie's loving your terminology, I can tell.
I apologize.
You're making her day with ethical hackers and clickers.
You should bring back the dunce cap.
Yeah,
the dunce cap. They can wear dunce cap for a day after they click.
We come up with a lot of creative ideas that don't make it to the Nicole doesn't approve, but we find education is the best thing. We find education, and while we don't want to have a list, we don't per se have a here's the naughty list. We do the naughty list. We know that your supervisor knows that you clicked. Your supervisor is talked to, and each business unit has a little bit of a different approach. But yeah, the dunce cap, I do like that.
I was just imagining, how in the Sunday papers where it lists like people who got promotions.
There'll
be a section of those.
I love your ideas, and if any of them you want to suggest strongly, we do.
Yeah, the stars.
Coincidentally, turnover is 11.
The scarlet letter of clicks. Here's the clickers. So,
I guess the only thing I would add is Peg is right. I mean, we're constantly looking at ways to how do you get this down even further, right? Because I think although it is a success story that we've cut our rate in half, and maybe we feel good that the utilities number is better than the corporation average, but it's still too many. And so we do look at and are actively discussing our, you're saying carrot versus stick. We're looking at and actively discussing, is there other ways that we can be thinking about this differently going forward? So,
well, if you ever want help brainstorming.
You guys, I know where to go, exactly.
I like the ideas that you have.
And at least I didn't mean to make light of an important topic. Yeah. I'm not sure about it.
Well, if you can't laugh, you cry. So
exactly.
I appreciate it. I appreciate that you make light of it. So
I do think it's really important. I do.
Yeah, I know.
So getting back to the security, because I'm at the corporate office and I said that the utility does have a lot more diamonds than some of our construction companies, for example, there is a lot of dedicated things we do just for the utility and the networks and the utility. And I'm going to keep this at a very high level again because we do talk secret sauce and we don't like to say, okay, and we're doing this and then this and then this because then everybody knows what we're doing. But I'll keep it at a high level. We do have, like I said, those dedicated security admins that understand operational technology so that they can speak the talk of the engineers, because engineers and IT people do talk differently and have different ways of doing the same job differently because it's different environments and it should be. It should be different. So we have dedicated people that work on that, and whether it's patch management or network segmentation or firewalls or any of those things. One of the things that the utility did that I think is leading edge, and when I talk to our peers, they say, did you do that? And we need to do that as well. And they looked at their personal identifiable information they have in their customer information system. And they said, what are we using that information for? We've always collected, when people get service from us, we collect their Social Security number, their date of birth, all of those things we need to transact that first initial meeting, right? And so you use that. We stored all that information. We never hardly and seldom had to go back and look at it, right? And so the utility said, wait a second, we don't need to have a full Social Security number for a customer who has been with us for 20 years. We don't need to have their date of birth any longer. We've already validated them. And so they went from over a million customers' information, that personal information that if stolen, if it were to fall in the wrong hands, could be used against our customers, to having less than 20,000. And that 20,000 is just new customers when they come on, and then after a few months that they've established their service, then it goes to the last four digits as well. That is something that is an amazing thing for our customers, to protect our customers' information, is get rid of the information you don't need. Don't be data hoarders. And a lot of what we discovered was a lot of people just save information in case you might need it someday. And we're saying if we need it someday, we'll go ask them for it again. but we don't need to store it. So I think that was kudos to the executive management team, Nicole and Garrett were instrumental in making sure that that happened. So
your system just does that automatically, that after a certain period of time, it just disappears?
Yes. It goes to the last four digits. We just completely remove it. We exit out. And so it's no longer in our system, no longer in our backups, no longer, you know, so in our, you know, it's not in any of our systems. We get rid of it.
And you're also asking for less in some instances?
So if our customers have the opportunity to not give their Social Security numbers, and I would refer to you a little bit on they don't have to give Social Security numbers. If they do give it, we get rid of it after a three-month period of time.
And there was, I guess, just to add onto it a little bit of a dialogue in terms of when we were making this decision, is this going to affect our bad debt collection? Because that information is what you hand over when you're trying to collect from a customer that we're struggling to get payment from. And what we're seeing so far, again, we're not quite a year into this, Garrett, right? We made this decision early this year, but we don't really have a full year to analyze. But we haven't seen any trending that would suggest that because we don't have the Social Security number, some of the collection is, you know, that we're not able to collect as much as we were, or the collection agencies we're using. And so far, so good. But that was really the debate was around, is this going to escalate our problems in terms of having more write-offs?
And the agencies thought that it would take them longer. They may be not as successful in collecting as well if they didn't have that information. But it certainly, we proceeded that way, knowing that that's the best long-term solution.
So the other points are really, they get to be very technical, and really what the third, I'll just sum it up, the third document. When you're trying to access anything in our diamond category, you have to jump through a lot of hoops and oftentimes can't even get there. You know, so we just add a lot of layers of technology and a lot more security in our SCADA systems and any of our electric distribution, anything like that. That it is definitely a zero trust environment. Also important is our participation in our local and industry cyber task force, whether that's EEI or the local SLIC or you know, North Dakota SLIC, which is the government and the it's got military, everybody looking at the cyber together holistically. We're in the middle of doing a physical security pilot. That is something that for many, many years, we put fences up, sometimes cameras. We certainly locked everything. We did everything we could with a mindset that we wanted to protect people from us. We didn't want people to accidentally get hurt in any of our areas by going into a dangerous location. So we had a different mindset than somebody wants to do harm to us. And so now we are doing a physical security pilot with that kind of a mindset. What would we have to put in place to protect us from others? Are we okay, or do we need to add more, more physical security? And so that's a pilot that's going on, so that there'll be more to come on that. We definitely do tabletops. We participated in GridX, which is the national exercise. It's a simulated coordinated cyber and physical attack. If you've never been part of one, I encourage you to observe. It is sobering and it is scary, but it is definitely well worth it. The utility engineering groups have done it for 2 years, and we'll continue to be part of those exercises going forward. And then finally, just to wrap up, I don't have anything new to say here other than it's, you know, unfortunately, this issue is not going away. And so we have to continue to have process improvement, adding layers, looking at what's going on, the anatomy of those breaches, continue to stay ahead of it. Security is everyone's job. We need to make sure that if there is an incident, that we have a good relationship with our federal and local law enforcement, because we're going to need their help. And with everything, you need to measure. If you want to make progress on anything, you need to measure it. If it's measured, it gets done. And so making sure that we have a third party to measure how we're doing every year, annually, is important to us. And that is what I had, unless you have any questions.
Peggy, do you feel like there are good standards for the industry set by NERC or others who have looked at what are the best practices, what are the best vendors or the best types of technologies to use to harden the system, like physically harden it? And then, I mean, I know just from the more IT security too, are there standards out there that are being used uniformly across industry, or is that stuff still being developed?
It is really still being developed, although, you know, there are SIP standards in the utility, which is, you know, something that is best practices. There are a lot of best practices. Those frameworks are really, that framework that we use, or NIST framework, really is best practices on cybersecurity, but it is really an immature market. Just recently after what happened that Pat's going to talk about on pipelines, you know, INGA, AGA are coming out with a lot more here's what you should do than they did previously, because it's an ever-evolving process right now that we just, that's one of the biggest things is staying connected with all those agencies to help us move forward. But it's developing. There's not really one standard, one area you can go. There's no silver bullet, I guess.
Is that because it's such a dynamic, constantly changing challenge?
Yes.
Or is it that, like, the federal agencies that are looking at this are just taking too long?
I could say that there's probably a little truth in all of that, but really it's so dynamic. And as soon as people get their arms around, or agencies get their arms around what the bad guys are doing, they come up with something else. We're also dealing with nation states. You know, we're not just dealing with somebody in your mom and dad's basement. We're dealing with China. We're dealing with North Korea. We're dealing with Russia. And they are very active. And so this is bigger than just a federal agency. This is at the very highest level of cyber warfare that we have to deal with. In the military, you know, you wouldn't expect Walmart to have, missile launchers next to them, but they're expected to fight a cyber war themselves. And so we find ourselves in that. But I think that more and more the federal government is getting more and more involved. And I think that's going to help. It's also going to hinder. You know, I mean, there's going to be a give and take. But it is so dynamic right now. And because we are dealing with nation states, it is a very difficult problem to solve.
So EEI, I guess just to add to that, EEI and both AGA have cybersecurity task force, I don't have the formal name of the task force, but for lack of a better word, it's kind of a committee of folks, and Peggy participates in those as well. So industry is talking together at the table. It's just to your point, there's not necessarily, you know, everything isn't, there's just not a prescriptive code, but there are certain, certainly discussions that are going on in terms of what others are doing, what could we be doing better, how do we improve, and that's where we learn what others are doing across the table in our same industries.
Yeah, regulatory commissions are battling the same thing. I was on a call yesterday with NARUC on critical infrastructure and cybersecurity, and the states started to report out, and I think 20 to 25 states reported out on what are you doing.
Yeah.
You know, everything from working with fusion centers to trying to find a sense of direction and coordinating with whether it's the DOE or other entities. But it's important, and that's what the committee is trying to get its arms around.
Those are great questions. It's a difficult.
Herding cats.
But I'm sorry.
It's kind of like herding cats.
It is.
yesterday.
It is.
I thought, okay, someone's got their work cut out for them.
Yeah.
Right. And we just, probably read that our ballistic missiles, systems don't have two-factor authentication, patch management, and, antivirus. So, legacy systems, those are things you would really, let's concentrate there, guys. Let's get some more security there, but it is.
I didn't need to hear that.
That happened. So
they need a dunce cap.
They do. They do. I like your idea. So,
okay. Any other questions for Peggy?
No, but thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peggy. All right, Pat. I'll turn it over to you to give an update here on the Massachusetts incident.
All right. Thank you. Okay, so here to talk a little bit about the Merrimack Valley
incident that happened out in Massachusetts. It happened about 3 months ago, September 13th of this year. So very high profile incident that happened. So really we've been getting some questions across the 8 states that we operate in. High level, just kind of wondering, okay, can you give us what happened there as far as facts, and then a little bit about our own system. So I'm just going to turn this so it's a little bit over here. So just to start with the map of the area. So Merrimack Valley basically included 3 different communities. So you had the North Andover, Lawrence, and then the Andover. And what's up there is the many different areas that this pressure system served, and then each one of those dots that's on the screen there basically was a incident in itself, so either a fire or an explosion. So all in all, if you go to the facts that we know today, what we do know is that it was an overpressure of a low-pressure system. What that means is there was 75 pounds being fed into this system, and then it was being distributed across the communities at about a half a pound outlet pressure. We also know that the sensing line that connected from the regulator that was sensing the pressure of the downstream was connected to an abandoned line. And the result of this was 1 death, 23 injuries, and 131 damaged structures. And if you go back to that previous slide, that's the 131 dots on there. So these are the facts that we know. Again, it's an ongoing investigation, and I will get into some of the things that we've since found out. And it's, like I say, it's developing as we speak. So I want to start first with what is a low-pressure system, just to explain that a little bit more. So it basically means the delivery pressure outside the home equals what's going into your house. So what you have is on most higher pressure systems, you have a regulator right at the meter set. And with a low pressure system, you do not have that regulator. So it's almost like you're eliminating that. I'm going to say second piece of safety into that system. So if it's a low pressure system, it comes from a distribution regulator set and goes right throughout all the houses. So in this case, it was 3 communities. And again, it's a large distribution system without that safety factor. It was their common installation practice in the early years of gas delivery. They are not installed today. They're being upgraded, but yet it isn't a common practice that we see in the industry today. And then again, the no individual service regulator.
Could you go back to the map?
Yes.
Okay. So where was that regulator?
You got your pointer.
Yeah.
I don't know for sure. I should say that on this map there was 14 different regulator stations that served this area, and one of the regulator stations is the one that had the sensing line that was disconnected. So I believe, Pat, that it was right there, right in the center. She's shaking like crazy. There we go. What's that?
It affected that one regulator station incident. It affected all the other areas.
Yeah, so, and again, I don't have all the facts of it, but my assumption is what they said is that 14 different stations fed this area. And they're all tied in together. So the one regulator set failed, had a sensing line that was connected downstream, and that sensing line sensed no pressure. Mm-hmm. And then since they're all tied in together, the whole system.
So
they were, raised. I mean, maybe just to back up a little bit, Pat, they were doing maintenance on this system. So they were were in a process of replacing the system, and that's how this ended up happening, right? It was human error, somebody connected to the abandoned line, and basically then the regulator, like he described, sensed no pressure, so it started flowing the pressure down, even though it was already pressure.
So wasn't it like they didn't, wasn't a maintenance thing where an annual inspection didn't find what it should have found? It was where they were doing maintenance and misconnected the line.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. So basically, it was, they're calling it human error. In this case, this area was being replaced. So the existing low pressure mm-hmm. system was in the process of being replaced. I'm not sure how, over how many years. But while they were working on this system, the sensing line at the regulator that failed was connected to the old line that was being replaced. And then it was cut further downstream. I think they said 7 blocks. So it was disconnected 7 blocks down, and as they when they cut that, then of course the sensing line is sensing no pressure. So then the regulator opens up and fed high pressure to the new system then, which was connected to the entire low pressure system.
So thank you.
You bet. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit then about what MDU has for low-pressure systems. So we currently have about 159 miles of low-pressure main, which equates to about 2.4% of our MDU's entire system.
Is that just in... Oh, wait, no.
Nope, I will. The North Dakota piece is on the bottom. So then we've got 12,600 low-pressure service lines, which is about 4.5% of the system. And then when you look at just North Dakota specific, we've got 65 miles of main and then about 5,300 low-pressure service lines, which, again, that correlates pretty much with our entire system at the 2.4 and the 4.7%.
The low-pressure lines that you have, would they be the same lines or different? A different part of the system from the replacement projects we had talked about on the aging pipe.
Yeah, so that as part of the SSIP, these low pressure systems we're talking about right here were part of that program.
They were.
Yes. For replacement. So we are actively replacing them now.
Yeah, I have a slide talking a little bit about
how that.
So they are one and the same or a part of that.
Yes, so when we talked about the SSIP, it included low-pressure pipe, and then, as you know, it also included L-delay. More of it was low-pressure than L-delay. From a percentage perspective, more of the dollars were low-pressure. That's fair, right, Pat, when we were talking at the hearing?
So then, really, what does it mean for the industry? I think my personal opinion, and I've heard others say this, that we feel it could be a game-changer. There's been a lot of attention that's been drawn to this specific incident. When you look at it, and there's been Senate hearings, it's one that obviously the NTSB takes over the immediately they took over the investigation, which they will own until they conclude their investigation, which happens on most, but in this case it was all boots on the ground. They sent a lot of people overnight as more information was coming. I think industry just in general said, wow, this is big and what's it going to mean to us? So I'd like to say that it's a game changer. When you look at what we've seen so far, a lot of those bullets up there is really what they're focused on or what we've seen initially. So overall procedures, they look at the engineering and construction of the replacement project that was happening. They're looking at human error, but it's what was going on and what type of engineering and construction procedures were in place that could have prevented this. Distribution Integrity Management Program, as you've heard me talk before, really what they've picked out on that is that we need to, as an industry, assign or elevate risk for an overpressure event. So even though most companies probably have some type of risk factor associated with pressure, maybe not necessarily overpressure, and that's what they're recommending is to take a look at that. Management of change, again, this is a procedure that's out there that's more focused on the transmission side, and what they're saying early on is, do we look at this MOC process and sharing that across the distribution side of the business? Safety management systems, Nicole mentioned that. Which is continuous improvement. Again, this is a recommended practice today, RP 1173. Will it gain traction and will it become a regulation, or are they going to let it be voluntary still? Public awareness program, and emergency response. Those probably tie a little bit together. There was quite a bit of critical finger pointing as the way the company in their mind responded to that. So we think as an industry, there's probably going to be more focus on emergency response and just the public awareness and liaisons working with the fire departments and local cities. Control room response, again, it was mentioned because there was the control room knew about this within a minute of when the pressure started to rise, but then they weren't able to respond for, I think, up to about 30 to 35 minutes. So, again, they will look probably at control room response and how do you look at incorporating different measures in there to help with that process. And then really just the safety culture, organizational issues, and this is all-encompassing, starting with top management all the way down through the folks in the field. So this is, you know, initially it came out right away. They kind of pointed out these specific bullet items. There's nothing saying that they're going to push more on these, but it's just that when they come out that quickly and say, here's some of the areas we feel that there was maybe some weaknesses in, as an industry, it probably means they're going to focus, somebody's going to focus more on those. So that's what we've picked up on.
Pat, one quick question. On just normal operations, what triggers an overpressure event?
It can be several things. In this case, and I'll talk a little bit about it, but in this case, the sensing line is what really caused this. The sensing line was connected to a system that had no pressure, so it just sensed that. But you can have other things. You can have faulty materials. So say one thing that is out there is weld slag in a piece of pipe that maybe does something to the boot in the regulator, punctures a hole in the boot, and then the boot leaks gas through there, which means that you're getting a higher pressure than what the regulator is supposed to let through. You could have a damage to something. Mm-hmm. You could have something where a vehicle would run into a distribution set and tear that out, and then now you've got this feed mm-hmm. sensing no pressure again, and it's still going through.
Sure.
So there's many different potentials out there. And again, the industry code requires that you protect in one form or another against overpressure. So there is ways to do it, and we... fortunately, actually, on one of the slides, I talk about our current design is a little bit different than what Columbia Gas is. The sensing line itself, the way I understand it on this station, was underground. All of our low-pressure systems are above ground. What does that mean? It means that you can physically see that sensing line, so you know that it's tied into the right piece of pipe. It doesn't guarantee that it won't happen, but it's a safety factor that just happens to be there for us. The other thing we have is we have full relief capacity on all of our stations. So in this case, they did not have a relief valve. We have relief valves on ours. So if the sensing line would have sensed no pressure, the regulator would have opened up, allowed this pressure to go through, but your regulator's between the sensing line and that regulator, and it would have opened and blown the gas to atmosphere.
Mm. Would you characterize your low-pressure system as more susceptible to human error, or were the two safeguards that you just described, would that offset that?
The two safeguards I just described would have helped prevent this, in my opinion. Again, you can't necessarily... Would it stop human error? I think that's always going to be out there. And in this case, I mean, it's unfortunate. We hate to say that this was a human error issue, but it was. And you know, you feel for whoever was overseeing this project. But again, that's where the NTSB is going to tie in all those other bullets. And even though it was, you know, we disconnected or they disconnected this piece of pipe does not necessarily mean that that's the only issue, that there was a multitude of different tasks that happened that day that could have, any one of those probably could have prevented this.
Prior to this, were you guys assigning a higher risk for
the overpressure events?
Not specifically for overpressure. We had identified low pressure for other reasons as a higher risk than some of our other pipe, but not necessarily overpressure. And that's something we'll look at in our next, as we run the next DIMP model. Again, it's how do you assign it? One of the things I picked up on in one of the documents I read from this is that you need to assign a risk to something that hasn't happened. So in this case, what they were saying is Columbia Gas did not assign a risk to this big of an event. But how do you assign a risk to something this big, and what is that? I mean, it's very subjective. You know, it's you don't know how to assign. What type of a risk do you put with an overpressure event? Again, in this case, you saw it affected three communities. Would it be a smaller risk if it was isolated to five blocks? Maybe, but how do you judge that? And that's the difficulty with the DIMP process, I think, and just ranking risk. Everybody's going to have a little different opinion on what each potential issue should be ranked at.
What was it that you said that yours is above ground and theirs was below ground? A pressure relief line, or what was it that?
Yeah, so out, and again, I think this is more common in the east and more of the urban areas where they have most of their stations are underground. So people don't have to look at
it. Is that what it was? Is a pressure relief line?
Yeah, it was a pressure relief line. So our entire stations are above ground, and the sensing line is one piece of that, and then the relief valve is also above ground.
So he was saying you can physically see that. So someone would have been, okay. Yeah.
And but then the rest of your set, you said we just happened to. So was that a good plan that you had that was wiser and kept it above ground, or was it, did it have to do with them putting it in way before we were ever out here, and yours is just a newer version? Or why the difference between the East Coast areas and out here?
I think it's, and again, these are 80-year-old systems, so it's fortunate that here, I don't think we have the scrutiny that you can get both publicly or, I mean, we have stations above ground, and we, as a company, to my knowledge, have never been scrutinized for having that system above ground. When you look at the communities in the east and a lot of these larger, it's like the electric side, it's they have transmission substations below ground in these cities.
An eyesore is what they say.
Okay. So I understand it better with buried electric transmission power lines.
Yep. So we're fortunate here that we've never been pushed to do that. It's not that we can't. I mean, we've got valves and a lot of other things underground, but today we don't have any stations underground, so we can physically see that.
One more question. Something you mentioned earlier about the regulators being connected. So was this a loop?
Yes, the entire system was looped. So those 14 stations, any one of them could have failed and overpressured the system. Okay, so when you look at federal, I say federal on there, but really it's beyond that and regulatory agencies. But as I mentioned, NTSB has taken the lead on this. They did come out about 2 weeks ago now, I believe, with where they issued 5 urgent recommendations. 4 of those were to NiSource or Columbia Gas, and then 1 was to the state of Massachusetts. So these are the ones now, when you take that other list of bullet items that I had, now you can see they're starting to focus. They're putting more focus on these specific bullets. So the first one they've talked about, again, is what I mentioned on that other bullet, the engineering plan and constructability review, including all applicable departments and a PE sign-off. So really what they've called out on that now as we gain more is that in this case it doesn't sound like, even though they had an engineering review, a construction review, they didn't necessarily pass it off to the measurement group, which oversees regulation. Again, would they have caught this or not? We don't know. What they're saying is this is a recommendation that you should have had all departments that have their hands on that type of a project review. The next one is review all records to ensure traceable, reliable, and complete. This is something that's gaining traction with everything in the industry, not just specific to this project. Apply a management of change or an MOC process. Again, that's gaining momentum now, and they're issuing a recommendation saying that they should have, that NiSOR should have an MOC process. And then implement the control procedures, including monitoring of pressures continually during gas main modifications. Again, this one here, I mentioned the control room monitored it, but what they're saying is, do you have, if you can't control it, then at that control room, do you have somebody there that can control it manually? And that leads to the next bullet, the assets in place to immediately shut down if an abnormal operations occur. So again, if you don't have the control room doesn't have that, then if you're doing a type of project like this, you should physically have folks on the ground that are standing by a valve to quickly shut it off. And then to the state, requiring a PE seal on public utility engineering drawings. So where this one's going to go, not sure. It's common practice today for utilities to not require that, but it could gain some steam, I think, especially from a federal guidance, per se, to start requiring that. So, and it's any public utility is what they're recommending. As far as...
So was their plan flawed? They planned the replacement wrong, or they just failed in the implementation?
I don't know. I think we'll find out more from the NTSB.
It seems like they're going all the way back to the drawings, so it's like they didn't plan it right to begin with.
Yeah, and I think that's where when I was saying it's unfortunate we're calling it a human error, but who's, you know, the individual or construction team that cut the piece of pipe ultimately caused the overpressure, but yet how many other...
Who told them to do that.
Exactly, or who not to.
Yeah,
or could it have built a different way where that wouldn't have done so much damage? You said all utilities, all gas utilities, or would that? Are they looking at new regulations for electric utilities and water utilities and everything?
The way it's written, and again, this is just fresh off the press a couple of weeks ago. It's for a public utility, but I think when they also mentioned in the one article I read is that utilities, state utilities in most cases don't require that engineering sign off for cities as well as the gas side or the electric side. So again, where is this going to go? And I think common practice is you have engineers, so you have engineering groups, and you have probably a senior engineer, and in some cases PEs reviewing this or overseeing it, but we've never required it generally to be sealed. Like you do a building structure or a bridge structure, you're requiring that engineer seal it with the PE. And in most cases, that's not the way it works for the utility industry.
This could have happened with that system if the line had just been cut, correct?
Correct.
I mean, whether it's an abandoned line the sensor doesn't know if it's abandoned or in use, the pressure drops.
Yes, it certainly could have. Again, this was all part of the whole process, though, since it was a replacement project. What they're saying to review that, you should have. It could have happened that same day. Somebody could have dug into it upstream or downstream of that, and it would have caused the same thing. In this case, the construction drawings said to cut that piece of pipe there. As far as PHMSA, they are basically helping or assisting NTSB in the investigation. That investigation, they're claiming, could take up to 2 years, which it normally does in these larger incidents. And then they also provided written testimony during the Senate hearing that I talk about below there, just supporting safety management systems or that 1173 and then also the system modernization. U.S. Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, they held a hearing on pipeline safety in the Merrimack Valley Incident Prevention and Response. Again, this was a few weeks ago where they had Senator Markey, Senator Warren were the two main ones that held that hearing. But They brought in folks from the company, and then they brought in experts to really just talk about it. And that's where a lot of what I'm saying as far as some of the issues that they brought up, they got pretty deep into it. It was a very interesting Senate hearing for sure. So a lot more to come on that. And I know Senator Markey did say that this won't be the only hearing. There will be follow-up hearings as well.
And I guess just one thing I would add on that, in terms of under the PHMSA bullets there that Pat had up, the SMS system, as part of our realignment that I talked about earlier from the operations perspective, we do have an individual focused on the implementation of the safety management system across our 8-state territory. As Pat's alluding to, currently that's voluntary, but we just really looked at that and felt it was a best practice. We've had some conversations with some of our commissioners, and I just feel if we're going to implement it in one state, we should be implementing it across our state. So we have just embarked on hiring somebody who actually came from Vectren. And Vectren was one of the first movers on SMS. And so we feel pretty good about being able to bring some of that knowledge to our company. Essentially, as Pat alluded to, what safety management system is a continuous improvement. There's 10 essential elements, but it's really looking at quality assurance, quality control. You know, do you have executive management support? Are you doing incident investigations? So, you know, when you look at it from, you know, broadly speaking, we probably have certain of those elements implemented, but I really felt it was time to take more of a holistic approach. And so we're down that road already, which is a good sign. Pat's mentioning that, you know, this may be mandated at some point anyway, but we have taken the first steps, I guess, is what I wanted to share.
So what is industry doing, AGA? They did immediately form this overpressurization task group, and then they just recently, a couple of weeks ago, issued this leading practices to reduce the possibility of natural gas overpressurization events. So that task group that was formed had about a month. It was very fast moving that came up with this leading practices, which was sent out here a couple of weeks ago. And then what are we doing at MDU? Again, we've identified the low pressure as a higher risk in our DIMP model. We do have a formalized replacement program which focuses on, among other things, low pressure systems under this system safety integrity program. We reviewed the low pressure station design. So again, we are isolated to just the MDU system where we have low pressure systems. And as I mentioned, we confirmed we have full relief valve capacity at all of our low pressure stations. And then also the regulator stations are above ground, where I talked about the sensing line, which again, could it have prevented this? Perhaps. Would it have? Not certain that we can say that. Assigned a director of engineering, or our director of engineering, to the AGA task group. So the one I mentioned on the last page, we did take that, and we assigned a director to that role, and he has been active in that group. We began the implementation of the APIRP 1173, as Nicole just mentioned, so we are moving forward with that, or have been now for over a year. Implemented the management of change, not as a result of this by any means, but it is, again, with part of the restructure that Nicole mentioned. That management of change now falls under my responsibility across the 8 states, and we're fortunate that one of our sister companies out west had a fairly formal management of change. So we have implemented that on September 15th, I believe, actually right about the time this incident happened. So we did roll that out. It is a very robust, in my opinion, management of change that really talks about really any type of change you have to a procedure or a practice needs to be run through this now, and it's a formal way of tracking it, whereas it used to be a lot more non-formal. So we've got that implemented. And then internally, we assigned this task group to identify the different gaps and review those procedures. So as most of these were mentioned in bullet points, the DIMP, the O&M manual, our emergency response plan, the pipeline safety management system quality. And that's where I think, as Nicole mentioned in her opening, is that the way we're structured today, it certainly helps when you have an incident like this. In the past, we would have had 3 different quality management groups. We'd had 3 different folks looking across the emergency response plan. Now it all rolls up under one department, and you can truly look at this collectively across 8 states, because it affects us all the same. It's not just MDU. It's the utility group, and what are those best practices? So again, the structure we have in place now certainly helps, especially when you're reviewing an incident like this. So,
Pat, I have two questions on this slide. On the first one, when you look at number two, formalized replacement program of LP systems. So I think, is there 64 miles in North Dakota or 65, it looks like?
Yep.
How do you prioritize those? I mean, are they all the same, the whole LP, or are there certain areas where it's they're more urgent to replace?
The DIMP group prioritizes them, and again, it's prioritized on a lot of different things, not just on one individual item. One of the things I can say is that in North Dakota, we historically had 10 towns. So of all our communities that we serve, only 10 had low-pressure systems, and now we are down to 4 as of next year. Those 4 are Bismarck, Dickinson, Mandan, and Williston. So do you say we prioritized outside of the bigger areas? Not necessarily. But again, why did we do that? One reason I can say is response time. If you have a major incident, we have more folks available in our larger towns. The other thing is that they are a simple system. As Pat mentioned, was that a looped system in a Glen Ullin or a New Salem? There's one station feeding that. So it's a lot simpler process to design and construct when you're looking at how you're going to do that. When you get to the Bismarcks and Mandans, we have not 14 stations, but we've probably got 5 or 6 serving different areas where it's a lot more complex, and it takes a lot more time, a lot more design, a lot more trying to figure out how you're going to do that in the long run to try and plan that system replacement out. So again, there's many reasons. When you look at our DIMP model, low pressure is elevated. It's a higher risk than other systems. But as far as prioritizing the low pressure itself, that's where we take a look at everything in the budgetary and having construction crews available. It's the time of the year. You just look at all that together.
This will be part of your kind of comprehensive overview that you come back like later this spring.
Right.
And we'll talk about all this in more depth.
2019 plan. And
okay.
Did you say May, Garrett?
In May, we'll.
May.
Yeah.
And then can you simply describe what management of change program is? Like, what does that mean? What does it do?
I'll do it simply. It's a management of change. It's as simple way to put it is any change that happens operationally or engineering-wise or procedurally, it's a formal way of tracking that process to make sure you're doing it right. And it's one piece of what Nicole said, the continuous improvement. So if we were to change the way we connect that sensing line, we have a procedure for that, we would change that. Now it's a way of tracking that to make sure that the right people are trained, knowledgeable of what we changed. So we at the general office made this change. Well, the folks in the field that are doing the work, are they aware of that change? And it's a way, again, it's a formal process of really tracking that.
Is this being talked about more across a lot of construction and engineering type projects, this management of change? So like for pipeline projects and like new construction, is this something that is kind of a new approach industry-wide?
Yes, very new. It was required. It was a requirement to a piece of TIMP, so Transmission Integrity Management Program, so it's been around for a while. The distribution side, or DIMP, does not require it today and still doesn't in regulations, just like 1173 or API 1173, it's a recommended practice, and it is one of the 10 elements that Nicole talked about, but it's not required anywhere other than in TIMP.
So as we realign and move to kind of the one utility concept I talked about earlier, we did go out and do a roadshow with all of our districts, and Pat was at all of those meetings when we were in the field. And the way we described it to our field folks was essentially what it is we're looking at common process and procedure across our 8-state territory. but we're not going to do that without asking for input from subject matter experts that are doing the work. So I describe management of change as we're going to get your input up front, not everyone's, but we're going to get selective input up front. We're going to roll those changes in, make the decision, and then on the after side, we're going to give it back to you and say, here's what has been changed, and train them on what that means in terms of their workflow going forward. So, but as, you know, Pat describes it, obviously probably a little bit better than I do, but I think it's a formal way of changing something and making sure all parties that need to know about the change and have been trained on it. And it'll be very important for us as we look to make our procedures common across our 8 states. Any other questions for Pat? Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Kevin to give a gas supply update. And I see Bob Mormon is in the audience as well, Kevin. So he's the one that's done this year after year. So no pressure. He's here to critique your performance today. I just had to add a little joke to
that.
Sitting over your shoulder. Yeah.
That explains a lot.
But we're happy to have Kevin here to give an update and happy to have him part of the team. So we'll go ahead.
That's a nice segue to one announcement, but I actually have two, so I'll just do them both right away. One is, I don't know if Kevin and Larry's presentations are kind of similar in length. We're a little over a half hour left.
Okay.
I have a firm commitment at 3:30, but so I don't know.
We should be able to
I know sometimes it's our questions that delay. And then you mentioned Bob being here, and so I want to make two introductions. Our new pipeline inspector is Arnie Severson, who's in the back there, and so you'll be working with him from time to time, and probably should have done it earlier, but Adam Renfant is our new public utility analyst
that is
on board, so we're glad to have them on board, and look forward to you getting to know them both better.
Perfect. Well, thank you. As Nicole mentioned earlier, I'm new to this position. I started as Director of Gas Supply in end of July of this year, but I'm not new to the industry. I've got 31 years in the natural gas industry. The first 18 years of my career were with MDU in a marketing, either marketing or gas supply capacity for the utility company. In about 2005, I transferred then over to the pipeline and spent 13 years with WBI Energy. So I'm not necessarily new to the industry, but I'm a new face to this group, and thank you for the opportunity to give the gas supply update.
Welcome
this
to
afternoon.
12th floor.
Thank you. And in the name of brevity, I'll go through these slides. I've got probably a dozen slides prepared. We'll talk about production, U.S. production, U.S. consumption, pricing. Naturally, everybody's interested this time of year in pricing and what the forecast looks like for the future. So we'll talk about that. And then I did want to end up with just a real brief discussion on our sister company, WBI Energy's expansion into eastern North Dakota, which is a tremendous opportunity for us and the ability to serve additional firm natural gas service to customers that we've not had that opportunity recently in eastern North Dakota. So with that, let's take a look at the U.S. natural gas production. This particular chart shows growth, pretty consistent growth from 2007 through 2018. What I want to draw your attention to here is the most significant growth in U.S. production has happened in the northeast part of the country, the Marcellus and the Utica, which you may have heard previously. In the last 2 years, has grown about just under 7 BCF per day. Another interesting piece, near and dear to our heart in North Dakota, is the Bakken. What is interesting in this slide is how really small that percentage the Bakken is of the overall picture in the nation. Huge to us, but at a national level, really pretty small, small potatoes. Next chart shows U.S. natural gas consumption. It was pretty flat, 2016, 2017. 2018, we saw an increase in the U.S. consumption of natural gas, as indicated on the chart on the right, largely a result of electric power. We had a huge increase in electric power, which added a little bit of volatility to the pricing that I'll discuss here in a couple slides. But moving forward, industry doesn't think that there won't be much change. We'll still see the same level of electric power, natural gas for electric power generation in 2019. This was kind of a neat chart I found on the EIA website. Actually, Bob helped me. I'll give him credit for this. Help me with this one. It shows the U.S. power gen by fuel type. And the drop that we've seen on in the coal side in the generation of electricity in the country basically dropped about 1.3 gigawatt hours. And that generating capability has been picked up by a combination of natural gas and non-hydro renewables, solar and wind. This slide is probably the biggest explanation for the volatility that we're seeing coming into this fall that we saw and or have seen and are experiencing in the natural gas pricing environment. And that has to do with the fact that we're at a record low coming into this heating season as it pertains to U.S. storage, the stocks available. Coming into November, we were about 20% below the five-year average for stocks stored across the U.S. And the trend's not dipping from that.
Why is the storage so much lower?
A couple things. I believe coming out of last winter, as people were looking at projected natural gas prices moving forward, there really wasn't a lot of difference between what they were forecasting for summer pricing in gas and winter pricing. Mm-hmm. The production numbers that I showed you earlier, everybody was starting to be comfortable that there was going to be more than enough production available in the U.S. And without that differential in price between summer and winter, if the production's there and we think the production's going to be there, there wasn't a big interest in storage for the summer. Well, what's kind of leading to some of that volatility that we're seeing right now is the fact that nobody did really store gas this summer. The utility company did. We stayed with our annual plan. We have a little over 12 BCF of capacity in storage in this area, and we maintained that plan. But interruptible customers, transportation customers, that kind, didn't necessarily feel the need to rely on storage coming into the winter because this production was going to be readily available. Then you add on top of that a cold October and November of this year, and there got to be a little bit of fear about, oh, if this continues, what are the stocks going to be at the end of the season? We started 20% below. Where are we going to be at the end? So we saw, and this graph represents that a little bit here. This is January of 2019, where we saw a pretty rapid ramp up in pricing. This chart shows a comparison between CIG index, Ventura index, and Henry Hub. A lot of MDU's gas supply is tied to CIG and Ventura index. And I wanted to show how those two indexes track pretty well with NYMEX Henry Hub, with a couple of exceptions. Back in 2014, if we all remember, was the polar vortex days, and we saw quite a ramp up in pricing of the Ventura index. And each of the ensuing winters, you'll see some kind of a spike, with one exception, and that was 2015-2016 time frame. And if you remember, during that time frame, there was a lot of gas stored that summer. We came out of the summer at 4 TCF nationally, record storage level. And we followed that with a winter that was 5 to 10% warmer than normal, warmer than average. So prices never really did spike that particular year. But big picture and in the effort of time, low prices are being, relatively low prices are forecasted for the long term. We've taken this out to November of 2021. So lower prices for longer period of time, but don't forget about the effect of the storage and the effect it'll play in the market and weather.
This might be a little clunky how I ask the question, so bear with me, but this seems to be one of the more pronounced price spikes in recent memory. And it almost seems like over the course of time, as nat gas production has increased, there's been less price sensitivity to events like storage, almost as, not that it, you know, crude oil seemed to still be more of an inelastic pricing model. And then supply and demand didn't seem to be driving nat gas pricing as much anymore, just because I think of overproduction or an abundance, if you will. So I guess the question is, do you think this is a one-off, or do you think we're seeing more of a return to a more sensitive pricing model?
Sensitive to consumption?
Well, just events, whether it's a drop in storage level or...
I think storage and unforecasted weather will continue to have a direct impact on pricing, and as it did again this winter. It places fear in the market, I believe, and that concern then is reflected in pricing changes. And while I fully expected to come in here and explain to you about these exorbitant prices that we're paying for natural gas, in the last week, the natural gas pricing has come off a dollar in a week. So it's coming off hard, and it's coming off for a couple reasons. Storage, people are not as concerned about storage as they were a month ago because we're seeing moderating temperatures. In fact, I think I've got a couple slides. We'll go through them later. But long-term forecast for weather west of the Mississippi is above normal or much above normal for January, February, March. The production growth that I alluded to in the earlier slide, people are starting to look at that, and I just read this morning they're forecasting about 750 BCF of additional storage coming out of the spring than what they had thought a month or two earlier, which will make up for the 723 BCF of storage that were behind record coming into this winter. So I think the market is starting to get more comfortable with the fact that we're going to have enough production. The weather's not going to present us with anything crazy. It still can, but I think that's a lot of the reason why we've seen that huge drop-off in pricing in this last week. Basically undid what was done in November and December pricing. This was just another quick slide, just to give you an idea of the variability we saw. This is NYMEX futures pricing forecast in four consecutive weeks. And while there's a lot of difference in the front month in what the market thinks the pricing is going to do, everybody's kind of coming to the same realization long term. Once we get through the winter, if there are no storage problems, everybody's forecasting a lower for longer for natural gas pricing.
Well, am I wrong in assuming that the forecasts would always be tighter in the summer months than in the winter months?
Correct.
Less volatility.
Yeah, but that is such a significant drop from $4.55 a decatherm down to less than $3 a decatherm. Like I mentioned earlier, west of the Mississippi, basically, with some exception, January, February, March, being forecasted above or much above temperature-wise. Not necessarily good news for the utility company.
We like red.
I do.
like healthy utilities as well.
And, you know, just this morning they were talking about forecast, but I think it's for a week or so, not necessarily for the winter, of like really intense cold in the, on the East Coast next week or 2 weeks from now. Is that much of an impact on this, or is it more are these markets more regional nowadays?
There is such a connection across the country that it's bound to have some, if that happens, if it materializes, it's bound to have some effect on our pricing. A lot of, probably more on contracts that we have tied to Ventura pricing than CIG. But having said that, I don't know if everybody's aware of the West Coast incident in October, where Enbridge had that line rupture north of the Canadian border. And we actually felt that shock in pricing as far west or as far east as the Rockies. There was some effect because that gas was used to supplement and to replace some of that Sumas gas that was lost, that Enbridge was delivering into the United States. So it's there's such an interconnection that there's bound to be some impact if we have a eastern polar vortex again. But how much is hard to say. But all this kind of begs the question, what MDU are you doing to help mitigate this volatility in the pricing that you're seeing? And a couple things. Number one, we utilize multiple supply basins. We don't purchase all of our gas from any single source. And we also diversify the producers that we buy gas from. So we have diversified basins and producers. We have a combination of index and fixed price contracts that we use for our gas supply. Currently, coming into this winter, we were about 52% fixed, 48% first of the month, tied to first of the month index. And largely, as I said, mentioned earlier, largely we're indexed to CIG on our system. We also have diversified contract terms. We've about 20% of our supply portfolio is contracted 2 to 5 years out. We've got about 30% of our portfolio tied to seasonal. We go out on a seasonal basis with RFPs. About 30% of our supply is contracted on a seasonal basis. And then we've got storage. We've got, like I mentioned, about a little over 12 BCF of storage on the Williston Basin system. And that represents about 40% of our total winter supply. A great hedging opportunity, buy the gas at lower prices in the summer and then utilize it during the winter if and when things are, or as typically as things are more expensive. This graphic shows WBI Energy storage basins. This is the pipeline, the high pressure pipeline system, transmission system that interconnects with MDU's locations in the four-state area. And I just wanted to bring your attention to storage basins that we utilize are again, diverse. We've got the Elk Basin storage field that we contract for capacity from on the Montana-Wyoming border. That particular field has a working gas capacity of about 26 billion cubic feet. In the central portion of the transmission system, we have the Baker storage reservoir, much larger. It's the largest underground storage facility in North America and has a working gas capacity of 165 BCF. And to kind of put that in, to help us understand how big that is, we could almost store 5 years of natural gas requirements in Baker if we had to. Trouble with Baker is a little hard to get it out.
Is that Cabin Creek? Same
thing. Yeah. Cabin Creek is right, that hub right there. Yep. And it's just south. It extends from south of Cabin Creek down to Little Beaver.
And is that MDU's or is that like a big
WBI.
A partnership with other companies?
WBI owns it and operates it, and we lease capacity out of it, would be one way to look at it. So
WBI is full ownership.
Correct. 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 This is just a quick slide to show the diversity in our supply mix. About 40% of our contracted supply comes out of what we call the Bakken, Bakken Formation in northwestern North Dakota. About 5% comes from a legacy field that's been producing for, oh, what would you guess, 90 to 100 years? I think some of the first production came out of there in the late 1920s, maybe early 1930s. But that makes up about 5% of our daily supply, winter supply. The new line I'll talk about gave us access to Viking and a little different pricing basin. About 20% of our supply is tied to what we call Canadian price gas, and that gas will come in either at around Glen Ullin or Manning, North Dakota. And then we've got about another 30% tied to the Rockies out west. We also enjoy the luxury of WBI's interconnection with multiple regional pipelines. We've got 12 points of receipt for natural gas from those regional pipelines. Mm-hmm. And I just want to talk a couple minutes about the Valley expansion. As I mentioned earlier, we're excited that WBI has completed this expansion into eastern North Dakota. It's something that has been talked about, analyzed, beat up one side, down the rest, my entire career with the company, I can remember. So at least 30 years. But it's approximately 30 miles of pipe, 16-inch pipe, that extends from Viking Pipeline in western Minnesota to near Mapleton, North Dakota. It comes across Red River. It went in service November 1st. MDU contracted for 30,000 dekatherms a day of capacity on that in conjunction with that expansion into eastern North Dakota. The interconnect with Viking allows WBI to expand up to 40,000 a day, so there's additional capacity there if necessary, and ultimately could take the capacity of that station up to 60,000 a day, 60,000 dekatherms a day, with additional compression. Here's a graphic just shows how that line comes into North Dakota. This would be south of Ada, North Dakota, near Felton, and it extends in a westerly fashion, crosses the Red River. Little town of Harwood is right here. This is Fargo-Moorhead area. And then drops down to the south and west to Mapleton, North Dakota, just west of the Fargo-Moorhead area. What Valley Expansion has done for us is provides us with some system reliability. If you remember, we've had only a single feed of gas into eastern North Dakota for years. So it does provide us a little redundancy. It allows us access to another supply basin. And it actually came in handy. In early November, the pipeline did some maintenance that interrupted the flow of gas to the east, just west of Jamestown. And Valley Expansion was used to provide natural gas service to the communities of Jamestown and Valley City for that 3-day interruption of service that happened on that transmission. So we've already put it to use, and it's exciting. As I mentioned, it provides us a little supply diversity into eastern North Dakota. It also allows us to reallocate some of our capacity. We extended that capacity out to the Bismarck-Mandan area and allows us then to take some legacy capacity and satisfy some of our other shortfalls in the other states, the Wyomings, the South Dakotas, and Montanas. And naturally, it allows us growth potential into eastern North Dakota. That opportunity to talk to firm industrial customers, provide firm industrial service, natural gas service. In fact, we're currently studying a project that would bring firm service into the Wahpeton area for a couple large customers in that area. So not something we've had the luxury of being able to do in the past, and exciting times for us.
And how many miles? I mean, that's miles. I mean, you go from Mapleton down.
Yeah, if that were to happen, yeah, that would be, what is that? 50?
Yes.
I was going to say 60 or 70, but probably 50 miles from Mapleton south into the Wahpeton area.
Exciting.
Yeah. It is.
We need it. You know, Wahpeton needs more gas, so if you guys can swing it, that's a good thing.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. We've got, let's see, Larry, you've got 15 minutes to wrap this up here.
No, we got a hard stop.
Or 10 minutes? Yeah.
The good thing is 5 of my 7 slides are pictures, so hopefully we can make it. So I just kind of want to provide a little update here on a project that we kind of kicked off, late last summer. After many years of work on, with many people here at both at Montana Dakota and at Bobcat Company, we finally were able to find a solution to get natural gas down to their manufacturing facility in Gwinner, North Dakota. So we kicked that off, last August. I think we had a pretty good event down there with Bobcat folks as well. But just kind of wanted to update you on the status of that project. We completed the 21 miles of line from the Alliance pipeline at their block valve near Milner, North Dakota. We completed that in August of 2018. And Bobcat began taking service off of that line via a CNG truck, compressed natural gas, is what we provided, because we didn't, the Alliance tap was not complete yet, and our station there at the Alliance tap was not complete yet. So that date was driven by Bobcat. They typically have a Labor Day shutdown, and they were able to plan their conversion around that Labor Day shutdown. So they kind of drove that date over Labor Day, because they didn't want to shut down production, other than when they absolutely have to or for maintenance or whatever. So that's why we did that, and we utilized compressed natural gas to provide the system supply for that new 21 miles of pipe. So what we did is we kind of put what we call a bridge plan together to bring that compressed natural gas from the Alliance pipeline near Hankinson, that we serve Hankinson ethanol off of that line over there, and use CNG tankers to bring them over to our takeoff point and feed the line for a period of time. Starting in November, Alliance completed their tap, so we were able to tie right into Alliance's tap right there. We still have to use kind of a temporary skid, which we're still using today, that actually provided the CNG service to serve Bobcat while we complete commissioning on our station, kind of our side of the fence, which I'll show a picture of that as well to
That's
kind of maybe illustrate.
At Gwinn or at the Bobcat?
The station at the Alliance takeoff, yep, at that block valve near Milner, correct. So, and I'll show a picture of what that kind of looks like to kind of illustrate it a little bit. But we hope to have that completed here early 2019, and then we'll have everything on the permanent service and everything will be running. We haven't had any problems serving through that bridge plan or keeping Bobcat going during that time period, so we don't expect any problems until we get everything completed.
Did you guys anticipate having to do the CNG all along, or was that a holdup on the Alliance side of things, getting that tap?
Yeah, it was something that we didn't anticipate, in preliminary designing the project and going forward. But it's something that, based upon the timelines that we were seeing and knowing what Bobcat's timeline was for wanting to convert, over Labor Day, that we started fairly early on this year starting to say, okay, our plan B is this. This is how we would do this to make sure that we could hit all those critical dates. So, and we worked hand in hand with Bobcat, putting together those plans for that bridge time period.
Yeah, Alliance had said mid-November that they couldn't finish before then, and it turned out that way. So good we had that plan in place.
Yep. So now I'm just going to jump through a couple of pictures. And here, this is actually Bobcat's favorite picture of our work on the new 12-inch high-density plastic pipeline. To serve them is you've got the Bobcat right in the background as we're fusing some of the pipe there on the project. This next picture is actually a lot, you know, as much as we could on this project along the 21 miles, we used the spider plow to plow in this 12-inch high-density PE pipe. This actually shows it going along Highway 13. You know, there's a lot of lowland areas, wetlands in that area, so, you know, there was a lot of boring that had to be done as well, but the plow did a good chunk of the footage on this project. So,
were you able to generally go in highway right-of-way as opposed to the private land?
You know, a lot of times we go on private easements, and sometimes, you know, we did work with the North Dakota Department of Transportation, you know, to go within the highway right-of-way as well.
I think over half on of it was highway right-of-way.
Yep, all along Highway 13, and we did work with them to do that.
Half of the mileage, you're saying,
right.
Gary?
Yep. Half of the mileage.
Because I know from other utilities I've worked with, you usually like to avoid that, don't you? Because someday then the road gets reworked and you end up having to move it.
Yeah. Typically, we like to be in a private easement, you know, but not always. Sometimes, you know, just certain various things don't allow you to be in one, but. I believe it was going somewhere around 4 feet, I believe, is what it is. I believe. This next picture is actually at that Alliance, the tap at the at the Milner block valve there. And actually what this picture is trying to show, and maybe I should have your clicker or your pointer, Kevin, but everything on that we're looking at on that side of the fence was provided by Alliance, and that is their. Make this work. There we go. All of this is the Alliance on this side of the fence. So this was their original block valve, and they've got their controls building and all of that, and then the line comes across, and on this side of the fence would start where our station is. And then here's kind of, this was earlier on, before there's actually a building over our regulators right now. And like I said, we're finalizing commissioning, but this is kind of all the regulations. So once the gas goes through, this is the line heater here. It'll come in and we'll drop it from that 1400 PSI that Alliance has through three cuts, go down to 100 pounds before it goes into our new line that goes over to the Bobcat facility. And this one here actually shows when the CNG tankers were there on site. Coming off of the truck, and there's a skid over there that brought it through the line to bring it down. This is where the line goes underneath ground to start that 21 miles of line to Gwinner.
Does it have to be treated at all to take out some of the heat content, or are they taking it as is right off the line?
Taking it right as is off of there, like you said, there is some of the liquids in there. In case there's some dropout, that's what this is here. In case there's any dropout, the liquids would fall out here and collected. And then this is actually odorization here for making sure that the gas is odorized.
And does it vary much, the heat content of that gas?
You know, Kevin may be able to speak to that a little bit more, but I think it's fairly consistent.
Yeah. I know our Hank and, no, this Milner point runs right in that 1160 range, pretty close month to month, at least for the last three or four that I've been paying attention.
So it would be the quality that people could use in their homes or
yes.
Other industrial?
The vast majority of the gas is from Canada production up there, so it's extremely consistent. There's some being dumped by the Amarada test facility up by Towner. Other than that, it's all Canadian gas production deep into Canada. So it's been, having watched it for the last 10 years in Hankinson, it's been extremely consistent. Mm.
All right. I was under the impression that a lot of Bakken gas with higher heat content was getting shoved in there.
Up at the town area, yes.
But not enough to change the.
No, it's gone up from 1140 to 1160 right now. It's been very consistent for the last couple of years, like Kevin was saying.
All right. So I kind of wanted to jump over to what we're working on now as far as hooking up additional customers now that we've got Bobcat online. You know, working to kind of complete our work and hopefully hook up additional customers here in as we move into spring and summer here of 2019. So right now we've actually secured three additional customers that will take service in 2019 off of that line. They're along the route from that takeoff with Alliance over to Bobcat facility. So there's three new customers that we'll be hooking up here as we move into spring.
And we're actually type customers?
What was that?
Businesses?
Yes, commercial customers. And then we're actually working right now trying to see if we've got enough interest in the communities of Winter and Milner to hook up both communities. So we started marketing to them. There is a connection fee that's going to be required from the customers, so we're trying to see how many customers are going to sign up. We've been working with both communities. We've had great support from both city councils of both communities. In fact, both city councils have agreed to pay for everybody that signs up by January 1 here of 2019. They will pay the 25% deposit required. The city will pay that for all the residences and businesses in the communities. So that's been a big help to getting enough interest to make this project feasible. So
connection fee an initial fee just to connect the first time, and then there's a monthly fee.
Right. Then our normal tariff fee would apply after that. And the way we, as part of our extension policy, we can go ahead and they can pay 25% down, and then they can make 24 months no interest payments for that connection fee. And that's the way we've kind of pitched it to the residents and businesses, that they can utilize that piece of it. So.
But the connection fee, just to clarify, is a one-time fee.
One time.
Yeah, okay.
Yep, one-time fee.
Can you share what that is? I'm just curious.
For the residents, it's actually $1,700 in both communities. So $425 down, and then about $55 a month for 24 months to pay that connection fee off, of which the city agreed to pay the $425. For the businesses, it's really specific based upon how much gas they use. So each business in the communities we have to work with individually to determine what their connection fee is, and it's all based upon how much natural gas they use for their facility.
Is the 40% a hard number?
40% is what a lot of times we see on a conversion project, so that's why we've kind of put together that connection fee is based upon hitting that 40% target. So that's, based upon doing conversion projects, in and around the communities we already serve, that's what we targeted when we put it together. So, right now we're, especially in Gwinner, we're looking very good, should be very close to the numbers, I think. Milner's going a little bit slower, but, we've still got some time for customers to sign up. And early on here in 2019, we will make the decision where we've got enough interest to move forward in those communities.
So, yeah, I guess to directly answer your question, is it a hard and fast number? Probably not, but we do need to do the analysis if we don't hit that number to determine, what is the impact then and what does this look like. So that's what Larry's alluding to, that once we have all the sign-ups in, we would do that.
Because I need to run here, so I just want to do one more. If Gwinner, let's say, is real strong for sign-ups and Milner is real low, or vice versa, does that make the whole thing fail, or can one of the communities stand on their own?
One community, we actually figured each community separate. It kind of worked out that their contribution amounts were approximately the same. So we said, for simplicity, to easy to market it to the customers, we're going to market the same contribution level. But each project will stand on its own. So if there's enough interest in one but not in the other, we would go forward with one project.
Don't you need to extend the main to Milner, though?
Yes. Milner, we have approximately a mile that we've got to extend down to get to the community. And with Gwinner, of course, we're right there because the Bobcat facility is right basically there in the community. So we do have to extend a little bit to get to Milner.
That's great.
Yeah, that's great. That's a fun project.
I don't suppose you dared use anything but a Bobcat skid steer in that part of the world. Is that written into the agreement?
Yeah. It was highly encouraged.
Yeah. If not, I hope the operator received hazard pay for that.
Well, it actually, in some of the equipment they did actually provide us some of their test equipment.
So. Oh, yeah, sure.
Yep.
Makes sense.
So the 40% conversion, so are you saying of, let's say, 200 homes and businesses,
First year is what we were kind of banking on, and then we know that we'll get some additional saturation over time, and we kind of built that into our model. But we figured if we can hit that 40% right away, that's what we based our numbers on.
So you recently talked to Dakota Natural Gas was the served rate, and they are estimating what they've seen is about 80% for the first 2 or 3 years, which is a drastically different number. So.
Yeah. It is, and like I said, that's what we've seen a lot. It really kind of, a lot of times it is a function of how much is the connection fee, what's the economics for the customers, for the homeowner, for the business, you know, what type of heating systems they have is common. A lot of different factors that can vary that.
How close are the main already?
And that the cities are contributing the
that's amazing.
As well. I mean, that's a big advantage.
I don't want to cut off questions if that is one to ask some more. I'm sorry, I have another commitment, but thank you, everybody, for being here. Appreciate it, and I'll let Commissioner Karasch just close it out.
Okay, thank you for your time. Thank you. Merry
Appreciate
Christmas.
It.
Thank you. You too.
So the standard main extension policy would still apply to the whole town. So I'm just trying to put it as like, so you would apply the main extension policy and those allowances before the additional contribution required by the...
They want your mic.
Yep.
So the company has a main extension policy that covers a certain amount of the expense of extending service to a community, or I guess I think it's defined more around a customer, but
right,
if you consider
right.
the entire community as a whole, right. is that being taken into account before the contribution they're required to contribute?
Yes. Yes, it all is all based upon our standard rate 120 extension tariff that we have, and you know dictates the more customers we get, the more we can invest you know, in the amount, which is essentially what the tariff says. We have a kind of a set amount for how much revenue we expect we can invest so much, and then the rest we have to collect from the customers receiving the service. So the more customers we get, of course, you could lower that contribution if you got way over that 40% too.
I was just trying to make sure we weren't just asking these towns to cover the entire cost of the extension.
No, okay. No, we're following that extension okay. policy.
I think we're at the tail. Any other questions, Julie?
I'm curious if you are looking at anything similar, or if there's any movement in Beulah.
Beulah
did such a great job here. Beulah is so close to being connected too.
There's always interest.
I know there's maybe not a driver like the Bobcat plant there, but.
Yeah, we haven't had any recent conversations. You know, it's something that we've looked at. You know, we've looked at several communities, not only kind of Hayes and Beulah. You know, Rugby we've had conversations with and several others. And you're right. I mean, it kind of gets back to what we've talked about in the past is trying to get that anchor customer and know that we're going to get close to the community and now moving forward and hopefully getting gas to the entire community. So. But we're going to continue to have those conversations, and if we can find a way to get gas to those other communities, we're definitely interested in serving them and expanding our system.
It's just that the mileage was, I mean, how far is that, right, from the line to Beulah? I mean, again,
Beulah, we'd have to probably be northern border. You're looking at 40 miles, I bet.
Unless you went to Dakota Gas.
Other than that.
Yep, yep. I'd love to serve my hometown.
I'm sure you would, Nicole. Kate, you take that one.
Yes. Got them on electricity. But
And, Larry, there's been some interest, like, up at Devil's Lake as well, some interest in some expansions, right? I mean, you're still working on that, too, I believe.
Yeah, additional expansions in around some of the communities that we serve, still looking at those. As you indicated, that Highway 2 project there in Devil's Lake, we didn't quite get enough interest level this year to move forward with it, but we'll keep working at it. So
John will keep calling me.
Yep.
How far is your extension in the valley from like Mayville and Hillsboro? Is that like still 30, 40 miles?
Harwood's got to be about 30 miles south of, or 30 plus miles south of Hillsboro. Mayville would be
another 12.
5 and 11, yeah. 3 and 11.
Something like that,
That's the, obviously, as Larry said, the further it is from, you know, a connection point, the harder the economics are to.
Well, they're closer themselves over just straight over to the Viking line, I would assume. I think that's like 10 miles or 15 or something.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think so. Yep.
All right. Well, if no one has anything else, thank you very much for coming in. It's always informative, and I appreciate the opportunity. I think we all do to learn more about what you're up to, and really appreciate the opportunity and relationship we have. So thanks.
Thank you.
Good topics. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. Christmas.